DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Sarah Steffen in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, Moscow discovers its love for bikes.
It's changed a lot in Moscow, and now we started to think about bicycles as a part of like transport system in Moscow.
Mexico goes green with rooftop gardens to save water and clean the air.
The plants on the roof here save water. Sometimes we have no rain for 6 months of the year in Mexico City.
And rangers in Georgia risk their lives to drive out poachers.
I noticed a strange noise coming from the back while I was driving. So I stopped the car, had a look in the back, and discovered a hand grenade. Someone had written on it with something sharp. Warning, go away.
We'll get to these stories in just a little while, but first, Green Week in Brussels is in full swing. It's the biggest annual conference on European environment policy. Special focus this year is on nature and biodiversity. Recent reports highlighted the dire situation of species in Europe. Things are looking especially bad for birds. Sonja Dean is joining us from Brussels now. Sonja, in a nutshell, what's the status of species in Europe's forests, skies and oceans?
Well, the European Environmental Agency issued a recent report. It's called The State of Nature in the European Union, and it came out with some pretty alarming results. So 77% of habitats and 60% of all species in the EU are not in a good situation. They have been assessed as being in an unfavorable situation, and birds are really in decline. So only about half of bird species in the EU are considered secure. Now, a lot of this has to do with the ways that agriculture has changed over the past decades. There's been this process of intensification of agriculture, and so this destroys habitat, and this wide application of pesticides over the fields, in a sense, this is poisoning the birds and insects, and it gets into the food chain, invertebrates. And the thing is, though, that food production depends on insects and birds, for example, to pollinate crops and reduce pests. I talked to Patricia Sarita. She's the CEO of BirdLife International. And she discussed with me the significance of biodiversity for the food production system.
I think we have to be a lot smarter about agricultural development. I mean, it's not about large extensions of intensive monocultures, what is actually going to get us there. I mean, we're seeing it's not only birds, it's pollinators, it's butterflies, it's bees, everything. And it's actually collapsing the system.
What's being done to prevent the system from collapsing and to protect these species?
Well, in the EU, most species protection revolves around two directives. There's the Habitats Directive and the Birds Directive. Sarita of BirdLife International said,
Europe doesn't recognize how much of a leader it has been setting up the nature directives. This is world-class legislation that the rest of the continents and the rest of the world are actually looking up to.
But as you've just mentioned, the state of Europe's biodiversity is not doing too well. So directives alone can't do the trick. So what's the bit that's missing here?
Well, the directives have been passed, but apparently they're not being implemented across the board. We have these very strong laws, but not all member states are putting them into practice. Sarita explained.
The problem is that we don't have consistent and coherent rollout of implementation of the rule. So it's not about what the rule is saying, it's about how is it being enforced.
Ronan Uhl of the European Environmental Agency, he did acknowledge this, what he called implementation gap. So he said protection goals are not being reached.
The point is that, well, it's not fully respected. So what can we do? Police? That's the only way. Enforcement is the other alternative. But enforcement then comes to indeed the ability and then the will of the different actors to really go for this compliance.
Okay, but so what would the EU be doing to protect species if not enforce its own directives?
Well, Uhl was quite keen on emphasizing market solutions as an alternative.
Well, what needs to happen is to say, can we go about greening the market? as a consumer, we may have the choice, and now we have more and more the choice. When we go shop, we see that on display, you have the so-called organic product versus the more industrial product. So this is really market discussions where the full chain from the producer to the retailers to the consumer is engaged. Consumerism, it has to do with the management of the environment. It has to do with the assets on which we depend to generate this productivity.
So all of this really gets back to the concept of monetizing biodiversity. And in fact, the motto of the conference is nature, our health, our wealth. So if I understand it correctly, this model, in this model, consumers are driving demand.
Sure, consumers can drive demand, but is it really the way forward to put responsibility solely on consumers? Wouldn't you still need to enforce rules and regulations to protect species?
Yeah, to me, honestly, I am a little skeptical that only market solutions can are the way forward. And that was something that Ronan Uhl, as I mentioned, was really emphasizing, but Sarita of BirdLife International pointed out some serious challenges in doing this.
We've been trying for 150 years to try to put a value on nature, and it is hard. I mean, and we cannot wait for that. And I think there is a huge opportunity on allowing private sector to innovate and to start considering nature.
Well, and then there's also the question, will the private sector do this voluntarily, though?
Exactly. And that's what I find not convincing. I think that the market factors are not necessarily enough.
Now, did you come across any success stories for saving species?
Yes, indeed. Sarita of BirdLife International brought out an example. So in the example that she gave, there were these mudflats in Antwerp, here in Belgium, which are important for migratory bird species. And there was a desire to expand a port on the river in Antwerp, and so that conflicted with protection and conservation of the mudflats. And this was Natura 2000 area, which is this network, important EU nature network. So in this example, the harbor company, the transport system, the community, the conservationists, and the policymakers all came together, and with innovation, they came up with a way of protecting the area while also having this efficient harbor. And she described it as being a kind of model example for ways in which the EU can really take on these conflicting interests and tackle that with innovation and new models and new approaches.
Sonja Dean speaking to us from Green Week in Brussels. Thanks, Sonja.
Thank you.
In many parts of the world, poaching remains one of the biggest threats to endangered species. In Georgia, environmental groups have been working with the Georgian government to stamp out poaching in the country's protected areas. But a recent rise in poaching has some environmentalists concerned that there's still a long way to go. Joseph Alexander Smith reports.
Lago Dehi, a humid, wooded wilderness in the foothills of the mighty Caucasus Mountains in eastern Georgia. One of the world's biodiversity hotspots, these thick virgin forests and alpine meadows are home to threatened animal species such as the chamois goat antelope, the red deer, and the East Caucasian tour. But the calm of the forest is deceptive. In this serene natural haven, a war is being waged. I'm hitching a ride with Gheorghe Sulamanidze, who is the director of Lago Dehi National Park in eastern Georgia. Gheorghe's work brings him into direct conflict with local poachers, who are out to hunt red deer, tour, and brown bear. As the park's director, Gheorghe spends much of his time monitoring the park from behind the wheel of his pickup truck. But one morning in late March, Gheorghe made a worrying discovery.
I noticed a strange noise coming from the back while I was driving. So I stopped the car, had a look in the back, and discovered a hand grenade. Someone had written on it with something sharp, warning, go away.
This is not the first time poachers have threatened staff in Georgia's protected areas. 2 years ago, in another of Georgia's national parks, a ranger was shot dead while chasing suspected poachers. Levan Tabuninze is director of Burjomi Haragauli National Park, where the shooting happened.
Two rangers, one chief ranger and a ranger, were patrolling on the park area.
When they discovered tracks left by horses, The ranger suspected that the horses belonged to poachers. They decided to split and to chase them.
This chief ranger, Mera Barevadze, who was killed, chased them alone. And so he just did shortcuts and then just appeared in front of them.
What happened next isn't entirely clear. Levan says the poachers turned on the head ranger and shots were fired.
He was killed. He was killed by poachers.
Levan shows me around one of his ranger stations. He tells me the poachers mostly hunt animals for sport rather than for food. Georgia has a strong tradition of hospitality, and taking guests hunting is seen as a great honor in many rural parts of the country. According to Georgian government figures, recorded poaching incidents in Georgia's protected areas have risen by 50% since 2011. However, it's not clear whether these figures show an increase in poaching activity or an increase in cases being reported. Over the past decade, international donors have been working hard to help the Georgian government to preserve the country's unique biodiversity. In 2014 alone, donors, including the Worldwide Fund for Nature and the United Nations Development Programme, invested some 8 million lari, almost 3.7 million euros, into developing Georgia's protected areas as part of their commitment to protecting rare species from poachers. Apart from the vehicles and binoculars given to the rangers, donors have also invested heavily in other technologies. Back in the thick forests of Lago Deji, one of the park rangers shows off their new camera trap. The ranger straps it to a tree about a meter off the ground and covers it with some moss. The idea is that when an object moves in front of the camera, a motion sensor triggers the camera, which sends live footage back to the ranger's base. While the cameras have helped provide crucial evidence to bring poachers to court, some donor groups worry the Georgian government is not taking the matter seriously. The Worldwide Fund for Nature's conservation director, Nuksar Zazanashvili, says, despite donor efforts, the war on poaching is not being won.
In Georgia, we see again some increasing of poaching level. This is very, very hard sign for us because we invested, not only financially, but also, technically, a lot in protectors of Georgia. This new government generally is doing better even, but poaching is increasing.
Rangers in the protected areas complain that, when it comes to poaching, law enforcement is not strict enough. The current legislation gives judges the right to confiscate a poacher's weapon, but rangers say that this penalty is rarely applied. A few months ago, donors sent a joint letter to the Georgian Environment Ministry expressing their concerns. But Georgia's then-Environment Minister, Elguja Khokreshvili, denied that there is a serious problem with poaching in Georgia.
I don't see that there is sense in talking about a systematic problem. In terms of the capacities of the protected areas administrations, in the last few years they've been improving step by step, and maximum investment is being made to strengthen the administrations. Of course, the resources we have are not sufficient, but I think it's over-exaggerated to suggest that there is a problem with illegal activity in the protected areas.
But regardless of the government's position on the issue, any increase in poaching could have a devastating impact on Georgia's emerging ecotourism sector, which is dependent on tourists visiting the protected areas. I met Natila Orujashvili in the kitchen of the guest house she runs in Lago Deji, just a few hundred meters from the entrance to the national park.
It would really affect tourism if poachers are going into the forest and killing the wild animals there. Tourists really love animals. They go up to the lakes and they spot bucks and deer, and they come back astounded by what they've seen. If the animals were being killed, then the tourists wouldn't have the satisfaction of that experience.
Meanwhile, environmentalists are up in arms about the killing of a rare gazelle by poachers in another of Georgia's protected areas. So far, no suspects have been detained. Now, after a cabinet reshuffle which has brought in the third environment minister in 3 years, the Georgian government will have to work hard to convince international donors that they are a reliable partner in Georgia's war on poaching. Joseph Alexander Smith, DW, Lago Deji National Park, Georgia.
Moscow is Europe's largest city, and it's still growing. In two decades, the number of cars on its streets has also grown exponentially, causing endless traffic jams and pollution. That's why more and more people call out for greener and healthier types of transport, like bikes. People at the annual Moscow Bike Parade this week dream about turning Moscow into something like Amsterdam or Copenhagen, a place where bikes are respected and taken seriously as a means of transport. Gertrud Kurkamp has the story.
Thousands of bicycles gathering right in the center of Moscow. It's a truly rare sight and sound in this city of more than 12 million, where cars rule and few people dare to venture out into the streets on two wheels. But today, at least some streets are totally theirs. More than 10,000 bikers have flocked to the city center to take part in the annual Moscow Bike Parade. Apart from enjoying a 15-kilometer ride along the garden ring that surrounds the center, the main aim of the event is to make people, and especially the authorities, aware of the bicycle as an alternative means of transport in a car-infested city. This is already the fifth bike parade, and the man who started it all, Vladimir Kumov, is convinced that the initiative has already brought about change. The first bicycle lanes have appeared in Moscow, something unheard of only a few years ago.
5 years ago, we used to smile when we started to speak about bicycle lanes, bicycle paths. But now it's like it's more official, and I think since 5 years it's changed a lot in Moscow. And now in Moscow government, we talk about bicycles as a transport. We started to think about bicycles as a part of like transport system in Moscow. It's different now.
To show that the Moscow government is indeed beginning to take the bike seriously, Deputy Mayor Maxim Liksutov personally takes part in the bike parade. He's responsible for the Department of Transport and says there is no way back. The bicycle is here to stay.
We are convinced that the bike will occupy its own niche in the city. Each year the number of cyclists continues to increase. More and more bicycles are rented, and the number of bike lanes will be increased gradually. I'm convinced that the bicycle will become ever more popular in the coming 10-15 years.
But still, says bike advocate Vladimir Kumov, many people in the Moscow government are far from convinced that bicycles could become a serious alternative for cars in combination with good public transport. The column of bikes of all sorts, colors and forms starts to move. Along narrow streets at first, and then out onto the vast expanses of the ring road, one half of which is still reserved for cars today. All along the route, there are small traffic jams resulting from the bike parade. Desperate drivers have left their seats to watch the sheer endless stream of cyclists pass by. Pensioner Boris Grabowski shakes his head. He's convinced there is no place for bicycles in the streets of Moscow.
A bicycle is for recreation. It is not a means of transport. That's impossible. The distances in Moscow are just too big, tens of kilometers. You would arrive at work all wet. Maybe 1% of bikers use their bicycle for transport, or maybe even 0.1% to go to work, if it's somewhere nearby.
Needless to say, the thousands of Muscovites, as well as visitors from other cities and even countries, couldn't agree less. Most of them are in a festive mood. Everyday problems, like the economic crisis, seem far away, and everybody seems to smile. Like Lyudmila Rufitskaya, who has just completed her tour of the city.
It was very nice. It's a very good reason to get together with people who share our interest in sports and a healthy way of life, and to understand that there are many of us in our city, and that we can, at least for the summer, switch from our cars to bicycles.
Moscow, she admits, is and will be ill-suited to cyclists for some time to come. Apart from lack of infrastructure, they have to deal with aggressive car drivers and pollution.
Of course, there's such a problem. But on the other hand, if we want to somehow improve this, we'll have to reduce car fumes and increase public transport and the number of bicycles. We have to start somewhere, and the best place to start is with yourself. It's still fairly dangerous because there are a few bicycle lanes. Not all drivers observe the traffic rules, and indeed not every cyclist knows them. But the more bicycle lanes and cyclists there are, and the more we develop this means of transport, the better.
Dmitry Semyonov is still thrilled by the single fact that he was allowed today to ride his bike on one of the main roads in central Moscow, usually a no-go area for bicycles. In everyday life, he tries to avoid the roads as much as possible on his way to and from his work.
I use my bike almost every day to go to work, but not in winter. In winter, it is too slippery. Moscow is not well adapted for cyclists, so I try not to use the roads. I ride through the park instead. Sometimes you have to use the road, but to really go out onto the streets is scary in Moscow.
Organizer Vladimir Kumov is aware of these problems, but he also recommends putting things in perspective and says the situation in Moscow, though certainly hostile to cyclists, is not too bad compared to many other cities, both in and outside Russia. In spite of everything, he feels comfortable here.
No, I don't think Moscow is dangerous. Moscow now is quite safe. And I think it's getting better and better every year. And I cycled in almost 50 countries. And I think there are some more dangerous places in the world. Like, Moscow is not the worst place.
This was already the second pro-bike event in Moscow in a few weeks' time. Earlier in May, Muscovites were urged to go to work on their bikes. The main goal of manifestations such as these is to increase awareness among citizens and to send a signal to the authorities that it is high time to seriously start building the necessary infrastructure for bicycle traffic in Moscow. Gerhard Kurkamp, DW, Moscow.
Beijing used to be the bicycle capital of the world, but today it's more a capital of traffic jams, just like Moscow. China's economic boom also saw an increasing number of people dump their bicycles for motorbikes or cars. But now more and more young people are rediscovering bikes. These days it's even possible to construct your own bike made from bamboo. It's a material that's not just sustainable, but also sturdy and light. Benjamin Eisel went to one of the do-it-yourself workshops for bamboo bikes in Beijing, and his report is presented by Andrea Rönsberg.
In a small workshop in downtown Beijing, Huang Kangkang is filing down some bamboo cane. It needs to be filed down the right amount, otherwise this part won't fit into the bicycle frame. The 25-year-old is busy constructing her very own bike together, made from bamboo.
I think it's really special to construct one's own bicycle, and on top of it to make it from bamboo. That is unique and really cool. You see a lot of bikes on the streets, but made from bamboo, that's pretty rare.
The glue that's used to fix the bamboo tubes dries quickly, so Huang has to work fast. She has a bit of help from Cao Juahui, an 18-year-old who's running the workshop today. It was he, along some of his friends, who came up with the idea to make the bikes from bamboo.
My friend David used to collect old bicycles. He wanted to exchange some parts to get them running again. Then we thought, well, bamboo is a sturdy and reliable material. So we tried making a bike. And despite all odds, it worked out.
It's not clear yet how durable these bamboo bikes are. Their first bamboo bike was made here in this little backyard workshop last summer. Now some 120 bikes have been constructed from scratch. The workshops they offer run for 2 days and include material costs equivalent of 400 euros. That's a bit too much, actually, says Huang Kangkang. But a personal mentor talks you through the whole construction process step by step.
Well, it really is a bit tricky, but that's exactly what makes it interesting. The workshop takes 2 days, and with all the effort and sweat you put into this, this bike really gets a very special meaning for me.
Once the last bamboo tube is fitted and tightly glued into the right position, the workshop participants wrap carbon fibers around the parts that have been glued together. That makes the frame more stable. Then the wheels, pedals, and the handlebar are added. And then finally, it's time for the first test tour. Here's workshop leader Xiao Zhuahui again.
Actually, riding a bamboo bike is pretty much like riding a regular bike. But when you ride it for the first time, it feels like you're flying because you've put it together yourself.
That report by Benjamin Eisel, presented by Andrea Rönsberg. Since the early 1990s, Mexico has been trying to improve its air quality. And a lot has changed in recent years. Bicycles are now part of the cityscape, the public transport system has been expanded, and the fight against smog has reached green heights. Anna Demmer has more on these green roofs, and Jesse Wingard presents her report.
It's a green oasis between the grey, dirty rooftops of Mexico City. Small trees, pink flowers, and grass grow here. The roof at the top of the Ministry of Environment. Just a few floors down, the ministry's spokesperson, Ruben Lazos Valencia, sits in his office. The green roofs are his flagship project.
The plants on the roof here save water. Sometimes we have no rain for 6 months of the year in Mexico City. And the advantages of these plants are their ability to regulate themselves. They don't need any looking after.
On hot days, the green roof acts as a zero-energy air conditioning unit, which also has the benefit of reducing costs.
The green roofs help with cooling of buildings on hot days. When it gets cold, they also have an insulating effect. In addition to all of this, the plants absorb dust and pollutants.
The plants produce oxygen, improving the air quality. Ruben Lazos Valencia pulls out his mobile phone and clicks on an app that shows the current level of pollutants. A yellow dot flashes on the screen. The air, he says, is okay right now. Green means the air quality is excellent. Orange is bad, and red means it is extremely poor.
Through the ministry's website, residents are able to obtain up-to-date information about air quality and pollution levels, wherever they are. The results are constantly being updated.
Mexico City's days of grey, smoggy skies are now in the past. Last year, there were only 3 days where pollution levels reached critical levels. The ministry injected almost 2 million euros last year for new green roofs. The budget is expected to increase. 35,000 square meters of city roof space has now been planted.
These are government buildings, hospitals or schools on which the gardens are being created. And then there are private initiatives, companies we assist.
In some districts, it's not just gardens that are being planted to improve air quality, but vegetable patches too. Just like in the suburb of Roma, Paco Iliala participates in the neighbourhood initiative.
People see how plants grow. They learn how to compost their household waste, and the compost can then be used again in their own vegetable patches.
Ruben Lazos Valencia from the Environment Ministry is convinced the gardens have great potential for low-income families.
To date, 5% of the area is used for growing vegetables, but there are always more and more people interested in providing food for themselves.
Blooming landscapes on Mexico City's rooftops. For those who want to grow their own food and have better air. Despite the practical benefits, these green roofs give Mexico City's young children the chance to learn about the importance of nature and the need for clean air.
That report by Anna Demmer, presented by Jesse Wingard. And that wraps up this week's edition of Living Planet. You can listen to this and past editions again. Just go to dw.de/livingplanet. We're also up on SoundCloud and iTunes. For more of our stories online, check out dw.de/environment. Living Planet was produced by me, Sarah Steffen. Our studio director was Eliane Gilarducci, and our studio tech was Gerd Georgi. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're back next week with a new edition of Living Planet. Bye for now.